They went on from there and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know it, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him. And 3 days after being killed, he will rise again." But they did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask him. When they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the way?" But they were silent, for on the way they had argued with one another who was the greatest. He sat down and called the 12 and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." The Gospel of the Lord. Not understanding, not asking, and not getting along. When writing about total surrender to God, Oswald Chambers writes, "I become thrilled with something infinitely greater than myself." In the ninth chapter here of the Gospel of Mark, we have Jesus define to his followers who the Son of Man is and what he must do. This is the second of three times that Jesus does this in Mark. He defines the Son of Man as one who will be betrayed, as one who will be killed, and on 3 days will be raised up from the dead. A definition of the Son of Man that Jesus' followers could not understand, for it did not appear to match their understanding of who the Son of Man was to be. They did not understand it. We would we not, as Christians, after Jesus has died on the cross and raised from the dead, understand clearly what he meant? And it is easy for us these many centuries afterwards to say we would have immediately responded to Jesus, immediately believed in him, and accepted what he said. But we have seen him raised from the dead. The risk that was involved in that day for someone who had nothing but to trust his claim to be the Son of Man and to do it the way that God was going to do it. But in all of our pretentiousness to assume that we get it now, for two millennia the church has indeed argued about its understanding of God, its definition of God. The nomian, the antinomian, the nomian in the sense of this heavy-handed, law-oriented, commandment perspective of God. The antinomian, the openness, the free-willing, the loving God and throwing out the rules that has been the ongoing argument among Christians. Now, most of us fall in some eclectic mix of both, a little of the heavy-handed stuff with supports what we believe, and the little of the open-ended loving stuff that also supports what we believe and want for our own lives. Self-definition of God. The problem with my self-definition of God is that I believe in a God that serves my needs. Now, I would like to claim that what I believe about God and the values that I have are drawn from God and who God is. But I'm afraid too often it's the reverse, that I hold fast to what's important to me and I define God in those terms that serve me. That's what Gerhard Ferdi in Theology is for Proclamation calls the masks that we put on God. Because God is too overwhelming, too powerful, too threatening for us to see God in his purity, that we must put a mask on God. And each of us puts a mask on God that serves our purposes, that matches what we want out of life, that matches our own values and our own beliefs. When Jesus defines God as one who is willing to be betrayed and died, we see God unmasked. And all of God's horrible, powerful beauty. And it's terrifying. So terrifying, we are afraid to ask, what does it mean? Martin Luther, when he teaches about the Lord's Prayer, as a wonderful understanding of that section of the Lord's Prayer, give us today our daily bread. He says, is it necessary for us to ask God for what we need? Or does God simply provide for us because that's who God is? He says, we don't need to ask because God will provide because that's part of God's nature. But the reason we ask is in by asking we learn from whom it comes. It's there, but if we ask for it, we are reminded who is the generous, who is the giving, who is the loving God that provides for all people. If we are afraid to ask, then we lose sight of what God does for us. Losing sight of what God does for us then brings about an argument, an ongoing argument among believers about whose definition of God is right. The question that's being raised, I think, in the argument among the disciples is the question, what does it mean to be a disciple or to be a follower of Jesus? Going to the old way, the old definitions, those who are the faithful followers will be those who are in positions of power, positions of strength at the top of the pecking order, the ones who get it while no one else does. But as Jesus redefines who he is, it changes that pecking order. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in A Testament to Freedom, writes that violence stands condemned by its failure to evoke counter-violence. That when someone acts out in a violent way, the way that act of violence is best condemned is by no one else responding in like with violence itself. I think the same concept could be applied to anger. That anger is condemned by its failure to evoke anger in others. You see, as soon as someone is angry with me, I am convinced I'm right. If you want to convince someone who has made a mistake that they are right, be angry with them about their mistake. And all of the systems that make us a human being will kick in and will convince that person that he or she is right. Anger is condemned by by its failure to evoke anger in return. We operate no different than human beings of every century, which is putting life in the perspective of honor and shame. To want to be at the top, to want to have the popularity, the recognition, the respect from other people. The problem is there can only be so many people who have the position of honor, and there will be those who have the position of shame upon which the honor has been built. And there will be a vying back and forth for who can have the position of honor and who will be stuck with the position of shame. But what happens if God is redefined? When the last become first, when life comes out of death, there is a new way for the world to be ordered. This unmasking of God through Jesus' betrayal and death on the cross is a revelation of a God who will die for his people so that they might live. And our total surrender to that God is to believe that there is something infinitely greater than any one of us could ever imagine. With all eyes turned to what is greater than what we could ask or imagine, we see the possibility for unity among God's people. A unity that I believe is faithfully expressed through the art of music. I don't need to do much convincing to point out to you that we live in a divided society. But I want to propose you that one of the symptoms of living in a divided society is when we see the decline in the use of music, in the teaching of music in schools. Because music is one of those places where we take people of diverse backgrounds, and all of a sudden, they end up on the same page. And a common voice. You can bring people with enormous oddities. And if you got to know our choir, you would understand those oddities. But you put that music in front of them, and there is unity of voice, and there is harmony, and there is beauty. And perhaps found in that moment of beauty, is a vision of something that we could never have asked or imagined on our own. Understanding that God is a self-giving God who dies for us demands that we give our lives totally to this God, to see that there is something infinitely greater than ourselves. And that brings about true understanding and brings about the possibility for unity among God's people. Amen.